listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with sports writer Jeff Perlman, whose latest book is Showtime, Magic, Kareem, Riley, and the Los Angeles Lakers Dynasty of the 1980s, which came out last fall from Gotham Books. Jeff Perlman is a columnist for SI.com. He has worked as a columnist for ESPN.com and Yahoo.com, a senior writer for Sports Illustrated, a features writer for Newsday, and as you'll hear in the interview, as the Nashville Tennessean's unlikely food and fashion writer. He is the author of Boys Will Be Boys, a biography of the 1990s Dallas Cowboys, The Bad Guys Won, a biography of the 1986 New York Mets, Sweetness, The Enigmatic Life of Walter Payton, Love Me, Hate Me, Barry Bonds and the Making of an Antihero, and The Rocket That Fell to Earth, Roger Clemens and the Rage for Baseball Immortality. Jeff Perlman lives in New York with his wife and two children and enjoys Kirk Cameron Films t-shirts and the taste of gum. We discussed his most recent book, Showtime, Magic, Kareem, Riley, and the Los Angeles Lakers Dynasty of the 1980s. The Los Angeles Lakers of the 1980s personified the flamboyance and excess of the decade over which they reigned, beginning with the arrival of Irvin Magic Johnson as the number one overall pick of the 1979 draft. The Lakers played basketball with gusto and pizzazz, unleashing their famed Showtime run-and-gun style on a league unprepared for their speed and ferocity, and became the most captivating show in sports and arguably in all around American entertainment. The Lakers roster overflowed with exciting all-star caliber players, including center Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. And they were led by the incomparable Pat Riley, known for his slicked back hair, his Armani suits, and his arrogant strut. Hollywood's biggest celebrities lined the court, and gorgeous women flocked to the arena. Best of all, the team was a winner. Between 1980 and 1991, the Lakers played in an unmatched 9 NBA championship series, capturing 5 of them. Best-selling sports writer Jeff Perlman draws from almost 300 interviews to take the first full measure of the Lakers' epic Showtime era. A dazzling account of one of America's greatest sports sagas, Showtime is packed with indelible characters, vicious rivalries, and jaw-dropping behind-the-scenes stories of the players' decadent Hollywood lifestyles. From the Showtime era's remarkable rise to its tragic end, marked by Magic Johnson's 1991 announcement that he had contracted HIV, Showtime is a gripping narrative of sports celebrity and 1980s style excess. And I'll just add, what I've just read to you is the description from Jeff Perlman's website, and I'm sure it was penned by his publicist. But the truth of the matter is, I am not a sports person, and I found this absolutely a gripping narrative of sports celebrity and 1980s style excess. It truly is. Anyway, on March 19th, Jeff Perlman wrote a blog post about the relative importance to his life and career of having written for his college paper, The Review, at the University of Delaware. So when I spoke with him last week, I asked him to start by talking about his early writing experience with that paper. I hope you enjoy.
Well, I'm from a small town, Mayopac, New York, and when I was a kid, I was a huge sports fan, like a huge sports fan, and I would always go to my local library and take out the sports biographies. I just, like, absorb them, you know. And it got to the point where the librarian would actually save the books for me when they came in. So if, like, the new Bo Jackson autobiography was coming out, she would call me and let me know she was holding it for me. And it was really cool. It was like it's one of those little things that you could easily forget about in life, or you can remember it and think, that really changed, you know, really changed my life a little bit. And so I'd go to the library and I'd load up on these books. And, you know, I grew up in this very, very small, very white, very sheltered town. And it sounds corny, but I really believe it. Like, reading these books about these guys from, like, inner city Detroit and Oakland and the Dominican Republic and all these different places with cool names and cool afros and styles, like, it just, like, really sort of did something for me and made me want to kind of see it. And the, you know, it was like the colorful uniforms and the cool names, yeah. Guys named like Caesar and, you know, Raphael and Juan and, you know, Lamar and like a million different names where I was like, oh, this is it for me, you know? And so that was really huge. And, you know, I wrote for my high school paper and in college at the University of Delaware, I wrote for the student newspaper. And one thing that happened that was actually kind of funny is I just really knew I wanted to be a journalist. And my senior year of high school, I actually kind of interned during the year at the local newspaper. And I got to Delaware, and I met with my advisor as a freshman before I even got in the before I even started my freshman year. And I said, "Yeah, I'm gonna be the editor of the student newspaper." And she said, "Well, that's actually, you know, it's really hard. It's really competitive here. People can't even write when they're freshmen, and blah blah blah." And I was like, "No. I'm gonna be the editor of the student newspaper. I'm telling you, I'm really going to." And it turns out she was the girlfriend of the current editor of the newspaper. And she told the guy about this really cocky, unbearable incoming freshman who he should look out for because he's just a pain in the butt and he's not worth dealing with. So I showed up, and there was like a lot of hostility, and like people had no interest in me. And they were right. I was this unbearable, cocky, arrogant little, you know, tool who had no business being that way. But I just really was, I had this focus on what I wanted to do, I guess. I don't know.
Wow, it's interesting that she took it that way instead of encouraging you, or, you know, maybe you just came off really cocky. I don't know.
I think I came off very, very, I was very cocky for no good reason, you know, and I always, it's kind of funny, whenever I see young journalists now who are very cocky and arrogant, it drives me crazy, because you kind of learn how, I mean, I'm not saying it's the same as, like, fighting fires or fighting in the military, but you realize how torturous this can be and how hard it can be, and how every word matters, and the value of really good reporting. And you don't know that when you're 18 or 21. You just think if you can turn a quick phrase or something that you're great, and then you end up looking like a fool, like I did about a million times.
So did you always write sports right from then, or were you writing about it, just everything that came through the paper's office?
Well, I had a really weird career beginning. So at Delaware, when I was at the student newspaper, I was mainly a sports guy. And I had a couple of internships. I had one internship in Champaign, Urbana, Illinois. It was still the worst summer of my life, easily. It was after my sophomore year, and I was playing basketball, and I broke my ankle. And then I returned and broke my other ankle. And I was 20 years old, and I was really cocky, but I had no friends. I didn't have a fake ID to get in any bars or anything. And I was living in this college town. I knew nobody. I mean, it was the worst summer of my life. But really important, I think, because I really wanted it, you know. So I got like 50 clips, but I was unbearable. And at the end of the summer, the sports editor wrote me this long letter telling me how I was talented but unbearable, which was, I thought, really important. And then after that year, after my junior year of college, I had an internship at the Nashville, Tennessee, and in the features department, not in the sports department, which is really valuable, because after my senior year, I got hired as the food and fashion writer for the Nashville, Tennessee.
Oh, really?
And I had no expertise. I mean, when I always use this line only because it's 100% true. As I talk to you right now, I'm wearing a faded, oversized Chicago Bears T-shirt and basketball shorts that are just stained everywhere that my wife begs me to get rid of. I can't dress for anything. I burn more grilled cheese than I, you know, succeed at. Like, but it was the one opening they had, food and fashion writer. And they liked my potential or whatever when I was an intern, so they hired me as a food and fashion writer. And
that's
amazing.
That was a joke.
I was terrible. That was horrible.
It doesn't really say much for how much they valued their food and fashion section.
Funny thing is, I know. Well, I did it for a few months, and I was the absolute worst. I mean, the worst. And they ended up hiring this woman named Ann Byrne, who is this really acclaimed food writer from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, who'd written a bunch of cookbooks. It was literally replacing a baseball player in Little League with Babe Ruth. I mean, it was the biggest joke. I was the worst food writer ever in the country. Could not be worse than me.
Did you get to stay there, though?
Oh, yeah. So it's kind of it's a funny thing. So I was the worst, right? I was at the Tennessean, and I was terrible. I couldn't get facts right. I didn't report. I didn't listen to anyone. I was just cocky. Again, I was just insufferable. I truly was insufferable, and I wasn't even good. You know, and that's the worst part of it. I wasn't even good. And I kept screwing up and getting facts wrong. After I did food fashion, they just kept me in features, but I could not get out of my own way. I mean, one mistake after another. And the local alternative newspaper used to just rip me every month. There'd be something about the enfant terrible at the Tennessean and how bad he is. And they were right. They were totally right. So my editor decided, one day she called me in her office and she said, "I'm putting you on the cops beat. You're going to be a police reporter. And I don't want you to worry about style. I don't want you to get pizzazzy. I just want you to go there and focus on facts and getting your stuff right. And that was a turning point in my career.
Okay, that's great. Now, you write a lot. You write articles, you blog, you've written 6 books. The most recent one is Showtime, Magic, Kareem Riley, and the Los Angeles Lakers Dynasty of the 1980s, which came out last year from Gotham Books. So I just wanted to know, like, how much is just work that you decide to put out, and how much is commissioned by websites or newspapers or publishers? And also, how do you choose what you want to write about?
Well, my main sort of living and source of income are the books.
Yeah.
That's like my real passion, and I really love it. Like, love it. And
yeah.
I blog regularly. I've blogged regularly since 2008. I think I just started a blog just for the hell of it, because it seemed like that's what you did.
Right.
And I ended up blogging about everything, and it was really weird. Like, I kept kind of growing this audience and growing this audience, and I basically, like, my wife, I mean, a couple times a month, she'll be like, did you really have to write about that? I mean, just, nobody really cares about the color of your poop. Like, nobody cares, so don't write about it. And I'm like, I don't know, but, you know. So it's like this really personal blog, and it seems like, I don't know, sometimes people like it and sometimes they don't, but it gets reads. I mean, and I guess my main thing is, like, my main thing are the books, by far, because they beat the crap out of me. And,
yeah.
And they take 2 to 3 years to write, and they're painful, and there are highs, and there's lows, and I always think everything I write stinks, so it's hard. And then I'll do, like, freelance stuff for, like, Bleacher Report or Sports Illustrated on the side, but really, truly, it's the books and blogging.
Yeah, and so do you decide what you're? I mean, obviously the Lakers were an important team to you. Did you decide to write about them, or was the Gotham Books coming to you and saying, "Why don't you write about the Lakers"?
Yeah, so I've had a pretty book-wise, I've had a pretty fortunate career. Like, my first book was about the '86 Mets, and I was just a baseball writer at Sports Illustrated, and an agent came to me, and it just so happened,
wow,
I grew up in New York and loved the '86 Mets, and I wrote that book. It's like one of those things you have. When you have no expectations, anything good that happens is just marvelous, you know? And, like, that book, I remember I got a call from my agent, and he's like, "You're on the bestseller list." Not, what? I'm on the bestseller list? You know, like, I was happy I had a book, you know?
Right.
And once that happened, kind of, you know, I don't know, like, success breeds success or something. Like, all of a sudden, I got another book deal, and then that book did okay, and then I got another book deal. So, you know, the more success you have, I guess the more opportunities you have, and people will take a shot on you. So, like, the Lakers, I'm always thinking, like, all right, what's a viable topic that I could enjoy for 2 to 2.5 years that also has the potential to sell and also hasn't been done or hasn't been done well before? So the Lakers, I just thought it had a lot of ingredients for a really good book. So I
pitched it. Well, I mean, I don't know that my listeners know this, but you know that I am not a sports person, and I was completely hooked. I was shocked by how much this book pulled me in. I was hooked.
Oh,
I kept reading things to my husband and going, like, "Did you know this? Did you know?" Because he does love sports. Anyway, that's the first thing. It's just a great book. I loved this book. And your writing comes off as so easy. I'm sure it's not as easy as it looks.
Oh.
But really, I mean, turning sports history into a riveting page turner it just really surprised me. So, but also this particular story, the team, the personalities, the records, and just how everything came together and seemed to work for them. So I'm just wondering, like, if you can talk a little bit about that perfect storm of this 1980s team.
Well, I got to say first, like, I learned this. This is a real lesson I learned early in my career, which is, like, you know, like, again, I was really cocky.
Right.
I was really cocky because at my college paper, I was one of the better writers, which is the dumbest reason to be cocky, right? Because you know nothing. You're just a stupid college kid. And what I've really learned over time is, like, pure writing skill is vastly overrated. It's like everything is about reporting, you know,
right,
and, like, making the extra call, then making the extra call, then making the extra call. That is 90% of the work. And if you do that, and even if you're a so-so natural writer, if you report the hell out of something, you can put out a pretty good product.
Yeah.
So the Laker book, I was just all about calling everybody. You know, I was about calling everyone, every player, every coach, every so-and-so. And all of a sudden, these stories start coming forward and piecing them together. And you know, I didn't, just as an example, like, I didn't even know before I started this book that there was this coach named Jack McKinney,
yeah,
who was the first coach of Showtime Lakers, and he was hired in 1979 to be Magic Johnson's first coach, and he was this beloved, awesome coach. He'd been an assistant with the Portland Trailblazers, and 14 games into his first season as a head coach in the NBA, the Lakers' first off day, he's riding his bike to his assistant coach's house to play tennis, and he's going down a hill, and he presses the brakes too hard, flips over the handlebars, isn't wearing a helmet, lands on his head, and is brought to the hospital as a John Doe, and never coaches the Lakers again. And the guy whose house he was riding to, Paul Westhead, takes over as a head coach and leads the Lakers to a championship and is handed the guy's job. I mean, it's kind of Shakespearean. So I didn't know that stuff. And again, the more calls you make and the more people you talk to, you just get these stories that you didn't even know existed.
So right.
There are like a million of those with the Lakers, just stories that I was riveted by.
And I was interested that you chose to start the book with Jack McKinney's story. It seemed like a perfect entry point to the book, but it did start the book with kind of a tragedy. And I guess that helped the arc of showing how they kind of went so high and then again kind of low toward the end. But why did you choose to start there? Is that why?
I don't have a great reason. It was kind of like one of these moments where I was like, I was in Florida, and I was sitting on his patio, and there's a folder that says Jack McKinney. It's my folder of clips that I got about Jack McKinney, and I brought him with me maybe because his memory has never been the same since then. So I brought these clips, and I'm sitting there, and we're drinking iced tea, and I'm sitting here with this guy who could have been, could have been Pat Riley.
Yeah.
And it was just kind of like this haunting moment. And even as I was sitting there, I was thinking, I'm gonna start the book with this. I didn't even know what the rest of the book was going to be. I just thought, I'm going to start the book with this. And a lot of writers will give you this mumbo jumbo about the depths of my blah, 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 and blah, blah. Like, sometimes you're just like, yeah, that'll be good. That'll work. That's
right.
Good. And that's pretty much, there wasn't any great science to it. I just thought this would be a good start.
The other thing that I kind of liked about it was it included you in the beginning of the story, although you're really not in the book, but this sort of helped us see you as invested in the story because you include that scene of sitting down with him.
Yeah, I don't love doing that. I don't love putting myself in stuff when I'm writing books.
Yeah.
I just thought in that case it was okay.
Yeah, no, it worked.
Thank you.
So I was surprised to read that at first the Lakers, the players on the existing team in the, I can't remember, 1979, 1980, they weren't excited to have Magic Johnson join the team. And I wondered if we could talk about this.
Yeah.
His energy made them look bad, I think, for one thing, and his fame provoked some jealousy. So.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of, I've covered sports for a long time, and people have this idea. I think people want to have the idea. A team is a team, and it's, come on, guys, let's go get them, and one for all and all for one.
Right.
And it's very rarely like that because you're playing for your livelihood. You're playing for your family. A lot of these guys in all sports come from poor backgrounds. They come from other countries. In hockey, it might be Soviet farm boys who are trying to make a living, trying to feed their family. In basketball, you have a lot of guys from the inner city who are, this is their paycheck. This is their dream. So the idea that it's all for team and you're going to sacrifice for the team no matter what is a little far-fetched and a little, it's like a Kevin Costner movie, but it's not a reality. if you ever saw For Love of the Game, it basically is that movie. It's the worst sports movie of all time, by the way. really
I don't
bad.
Think so, I've seen it. I'm just...
Oh, my God. It's so bad. It's on HBO every once in a while. It was my wife and I's second date. It's the worst movie ever. we stayed together, though, so that worked
That's
out.
Good.
So Magic comes along, and they already have a really good point guard named Norm Nixon, and he's a liked guy, and he has kind of a chip on his shoulder. He wasn't their first pick, draft pick. He's undersized. He came from Duquesne, which is a small basketball school. So they bring in Magic Johnson, number one pick, Michigan State. He's rolling with the owner. They're going to the Playboy Mansion. He talks about bringing the Magic back to L.A., and these guys are like, are you freaking kidding me? we're a good team. We have another point guard? And, then he shows up at camp, and he's out hustling everyone. And there's a lot, again, like, few fans like to think that it's, come on, guys, let's just go our hardest. And there's a lot of, stop showing us up, all right,
yeah.
Rookie. Cut this out. What are you trying to do, all right? We have a long season ahead of us. So guys did not love that, And over time, the reality is he was just a brilliant basketball player, leader, everything you would want in a player. So, and that became pretty undeniable. And his the force of that guy's magnetism is stronger than Norm Nixon.
Yeah, yeah. I really enjoyed the amount of time you spent getting us to know Magic Johnson, which was completely, obviously, well-deserved. But I was really, like, by the time he actually gets on the team and starts practicing with the team after you've given us his background, I was sort of worried that, like, how is he going to hold his own, you know, with this team? He's such a nice guy. He's so innocent, you know. But this really interesting story you tell about how he got elbowed in the face at one point, and then he knocked the guy down, or he punched him in the neck, and he really, and later somebody said to you, Irvin was respectful, but he did not take anything. So that was really interesting to me. I never see that side of Magic Johnson, that he had the confidence to punch out an NBA player in an early practice when he felt he was being disrespected.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know what, like, you know, pro sports is cutthroat.
Right.
It is. And the weak don't survive. And he was lovable, and he was basically a squeezy toy. That's how he came off to the public, and he was by and large that guy. But on the court, I mean, people always compare him and Larry Bird, and the thing both those guys had is they were truly cutthroat killers, and they would do anything to win a basketball game. I mean, anything to win a basketball game. And one of the things that had plagued the Lakers for a long time before him is there was a lot of kind of glory guys who, you know, you love playing in LA and the perks that come with it and the women and the cars and the drugs and blah, blah, blah. And that guy was about winning. I mean, he had a lot of fun. Obviously, he had a lot of women. Obviously, it came back to bite him.
Right.
But first and foremost, that guy was a killer on the basketball court, an absolute killer on the basketball court.
Right, and I guess I could see that with the opposition, but it surprised me that he was able to be so confident early on with his own team.
But these guys were giving him a lot of crap. You know, they were not happy he was there, and he was tired of it. It's so funny. He's one of the most interesting characters, I think, in modern sports. And I actually think, people don't say this, I consider Magic Johnson almost like the closest thing we have to another Muhammad Ali, as far as the impact he has on people, the magnetism of his smile, the stature, what he's done after basketball is almost more impressive than what he did during that. It is more impressive. I mean, you know, the guy comes along and he decides he's going to develop this business plan for inner city. He's going to build movie theaters. He's going to bring in Starbucks to inner city, mostly minority neighborhoods in Southern California. And, like, you know, he kind of opened the door for something really big.
Yeah. He's somebody who always just seems like you just would love to just get to know him.
Yeah.
Like the other night, I of course wasn't watching, but my husband's watching the March Madness, and there's Magic in the audience, you know, and he's just standing there clapping. And
he's everywhere.
Like, my God, the guy next to him must be so psyched.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, so Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, he was a huge part, obviously, of this team even before Magic arrived, and he was kind of the focus of the team before Magic arrived, and he was known to be moody and withdrawn and sometimes rude. I was wondering, first of all, if you've ever met him.
Kareem, I have actually not.
You've not?
I have never met. No, he would not talk. I sent a, it was made clear he wouldn't talk, and I got a, I got an email from a friend of mine at Slam Magazine, a basketball magazine, who said, you know, I'm interviewing Kareem for something in a few days. Do you want me to ask him the questions? And I said, great. So I asked what I needed asked, but it wasn't ideal, you know.
Okay. All right. So you write about an early experience. I think he was actually still a rookie at this point, but this sports writer named Joe Falls disparages him after a press conference because he kept his hands in his pockets and he was speaking monosyllabically. And I was wondering if you could relate to this at all, the way that this writer felt. Do you ever feel like the players owe a certain scintillating personality to their fans and the media? Could you relate to that?
I don't think they owe personality. I think decency is nice, you know, and I've covered my fair share of athletes who, it's almost like how I was when I was like 20 and whatever, like, who think because they have the power of hitting up, you know, a ball with a piece of wood, or that they have the ability to take a round object and throw it in a tin cylinder 10 feet in the air, that this somehow gives them the, you know, leeway or gives them license to treat people like they're, you know, excrement on the bottom of their shoes.
Right, right.
So it's not like I don't think you have to be exciting. I don't think you have to be wonderful. I think if you're shy, you're shy. If you're outgoing, you're outgoing. I struggle with athletes who treat the media like they're idiots or jerks or the enemy.
Right.
I hate that. I have always hated that.
And you actually did relay a story of Kareem sort of mouthing off to a little kid who'd ask for an autograph, and that sort of turned me against him. It's like, shy is fine, but don't be mean to the kids. And I'm sure it's irritating to always be hounded by the people, but...
I think he... someone used the term, and I use it in the books, like socially retarded. You know, I have a brother with Asperger's, and he has a minor... It's a minor sort of thing, but... When I started researching Kareem, I thought, you know what, I wonder if this guy has Asperger's, because his inability to interact socially with people, I almost think it wasn't by choice, because why would you choose to be that mean and that disengaged? And I understand he had a very, very rough background, a very tough childhood, kind of became a museum centerpiece from the time he was very young. I don't know, though. I never thought, I don't like the way he treated people. I still don't.
Yeah, okay. I want to talk a little bit about the way you include some of the interview content in the book, just sort of as a writing method, and it flows really well. The story is told through accumulated viewpoints of many people sometimes who were on the team or close to the team, I'm sure through interviews. And at a certain point, I realized that you were sort of, sometimes you cross-cut relevant comments from different interviews into a single segment by subject.
Yeah.
Do you mind if I read something from the book?
Go ahead.
Okay. During the early days of training camp, Johnson had expressed concern over ordering Abdul-Jabbar around on the court. He was, after all, a mere 20-year-old rookie. "I can't tell Kareem what to do," he said to McKinney. "Why would he listen to me?" "Well," McKinney replied, "one of us has to do it. If you're not up for leading this team, I'll just have to." "No, no, no," Johnson replied. "I'll do it." "And he did," said Michael Cooper. It was the way Magic gained respect right off the bat. He was unafraid of confronting the big man. Anyway, so I'm sort of guessing this came from at least two conversations, unless you got that whole story from Cooper. But it was just interesting the way that Michael Cooper comes in as like the voice of the story, you know, telling that this is what happened, even though originally it starts out just being a dialogue between Johnson and McKinney. And it was interesting to me that it worked really well. So I just wondered if we could talk about that.
No, I appreciate that. It's kind of like, all right, you find out something, whatever it may be. You find out about a conversation. You find out about an incident. And then, like, you ask everyone about it. You know, like, I'll ask everyone about it. And a lot of the perspectives will stink. Oh, I don't remember that. Or, oh, I kind of remember that. Or they'll totally remember it wrongly. And so you move on from them. And, you know, you just, it's like, you know, it's funny. Like, when you said, like, it all seems, it all flows easily or whatever. You make it seem easy or whatever. Like, it's anything but, you know, like, it's really torturous and really hard. And I'm really into the minutia. Like, I'm really into the minutia. So if there's some small little conversation like that, I want to know everything about it. So I'll try to find every article about it. Then I'll try to find if it's been talked about in books. Then I'll interview every player I can find about it. And, you know, Cooper happened to be a great interview, like a great interview, very open. His ex-wife was even better. I mean, amazing.
Wanda? Is that name?
Wanda. Oh, yeah. Love Wanda. And okay. Just the best. And she's just great. They're great. And when you find people like that, Michael Cooper or Wanda Cooper or whoever, they're kind of, I think of them as like go-to people. And so if I have something, let's say there's a conversation, I'll specifically make sure to go back to the go-to people and be like, do you remember this or how did this go? Because you also realize, like, there's certain people whose memories are rock solid. There are other people whose memories are a little flimsy. And when you find the people who have very, very good memories and very good recollections, you'll go to them again and again and again.
Yeah.
Sort of like that.
Yeah. And they probably enjoy telling their stories. If you can tell that they enjoy it, then it's probably easy to go back because they're happy to keep talking about it.
Well, I think people, it's kind of funny. Like, some of my books, people will be like, you're digging up dirt and blah, blah, blah. And, like, you're not digging up dirt. People, it's like people talking about their old days of the old fraternity, or like even my old days of the college newspaper. We did some stuff that was kind of embarrassing, and you did some stuff that was kind of gross, and you did some stuff that was kind of amazing. And here's someone 20 years later who wants to talk to you about it, and wants to hear about it, and wants to tell your stories. The people involved are generally thrilled, you know. So like, I go back to Michael Cooper. I'm basically saying to these people, I'm writing a book about the greatest days of your life. Would you like to talk about it? You know, okay, that sounds great, you know. They don't always agree, but most of the time they do, because it's a wonderful time period.
Right, yeah. And you're not just dishing dirt on other people. I mean, I noticed on your blog, you're really self-deprecating. You're happy to dish your own dirt, too. I mean, it's not just one way, so I think that makes the tone of it different.
Well, I always think, why, I just don't care. You know, I don't even think of it as dirt. I'm not even just saying that. I really don't think of it as dirt. Like, I wrote a book about Walter Payton, the former Chicago Bear running back, and he died in 1999. Book came out a couple years ago, and a lot of people are like, oh, this is terrible, especially in Chicago. A lot of people, having not read the book, really killed me over the book. And how can you come out with this now? You know, some stuff about, like, infidelity and his painkillers after he was done playing. And to me, like, finding out that someone is human and talking about someone's life and talking about the shortcomings as well as the successes, like, that's not dirt.
Right.
Dirt is maybe you slept with a hooker or something like that. That's just life. It's like what makes you. All these little experiences what make you.
And actually, I have a question about that. Maybe I'll go to that one now because it's relevant. So sports fans are notably passionate about their teams and players, and they're often, you know, opinionated and sometimes kind of scary. So I was wondering if you actually say on your bio that you're thin-skinned, which is funny. And I'm thinking, like, to write about sports and put up with the comments that you must get sometimes and the reactions that people have, is that ever difficult?
Oh, yeah, it's so hard. My wife always says, she's like, I don't know how can you deal with this stuff, you know? Like, and I don't really know how I do either, because it's, some of it's really painful. You know, like, it's not like, all right, like, sometimes someone will be like, you know, like, I shave my head, right? And someone will be like, oh, you're, look at you, baldy, right? And I'm not even bald, I just shave my head, right? But, like, even if I were bald, like, I'm a married 42-year-old guy with two kids. Wow, that's the best you can do, right? So that stuff, which is a solid 50% of it, like, who cares? Not a big deal. When people, like, when people question your sort of integrity, right, or, you know, like, you're just doing it for the money, or you're, what, I don't know, like, stuff like that, it's generally painful. You know, it's really painful. I can deal with someone like, oh, your book sucks. All right, you think my book sucks. I'm okay with that. But, like, when people question your integrity or your reason for doing something, or they think you're just, you know, Kitty Kelly comparisons, stuff like that, that stuff really hurts. It really gets me. It truly does. And there's nothing I can do about it. I don't think, like, something like Michael Lewis or Laura Hillebrand, I don't think they even worry about this stuff. Right. I think I just have a lot thinner skin than they do, sadly.
Yeah, okay. Now, your career has spanned a certain period of time that makes me think that you've sort of seen big changes in the media of media. So print journalism and now onto a much more online journalism. So I'm wondering how you think this has affected the quality of sports news, if at all.
That's a good question. I mean, you know, it's funny because when I came out of college, the dream of everyone there was to work for a newspaper. And I bet if you go to a college, you know, whatever media program right now, nobody's dreaming of, like, picking up the front page of whatever paper and having their story appear in print. I don't even think it's a thought, you know?
Right.
Which is sad to me. I mean, I understand it. It just kind of bums me out. I still consider myself a newspaper guy, and I haven't worked for a newspaper in a long time. I think the one thing that's really hurt reporting in a lot of ways is Twitter. People throw stuff out there, and it gets reported very quickly without confirming it, and there's this rush now. If you're if you're Tyler Kepner, baseball writer for the New York Times, who's just this great baseball writer, you never had to worry about tweeting out stuff or, you know, being first with, you know, on the internet. You know, being first used to be have a scoop for the next day's paper. You know, so you had time to cultivate, you had time to make calls. Now it's who can get it out there first.
In whatever form, right? 140
in whatever
characters.
Form. Yeah. Yeah, right. In 140 characters, and the verification isn't what it was. The development isn't what it was. So I find that a little troubling. But I also think, like, it's easy to sound like a dinosaur, you know, and I don't want to be a dinosaur. So I can also say that I kind of like what's going on in news, in sports media right now. There are a lot of great long form sports websites that never existed before. There are more and more places where people can write. There's good and bad. I don't know. It's good and bad. It's dizzying. Definitely dizzying.
Yeah, I would think so. So you have a blog that's pretty great. It's not just about sports. It covers politics and culture and environment. I don't know, entertainment. And you seem to write about whatever strikes your fancy. I really like the Quaz, which is a regular feature that you do of a Q&A with people that you find interesting. So let's talk about your blog. How you mentioned that you just sort of started it because that seemed to be what people were doing.
Yeah. It's a funny thing. Like, people always say, like, I get a lot of emails like, God, you really seem angry, right? Like, you must be the most miserable human being in the history of the world because
really?
You always seem angry. And I kind of, the blog has become a really, really awesome vent for me and has been for a long time now.
Yeah, yeah.
Where I see some, you know, like, I'm pretty liberal. I see, like, Ted Cruz yesterday.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, I have to blog about this guy because I can't stand him, right? Okay, so I put that out there. Or we moved to California a couple months ago, and you know, like the drought situation here is really dire, and I walk around and everyone's watering their lawns, and I can't. What are you doing watering your freaking lawn? So I can't really yell at people. You know, I can't go out and start screaming at people. So what I do is I just blog about it and I write about it, and it just kind of, it's like a great, it's like getting a massage or something. It's a great release for me. So that's kind of what it is. And you know, it's also like, you know, it gives you a web presence, which you need. It's a way to promote books. And then I started doing this Q&A like 4 years ago. It was totally, it's really funny. It's become my pride and joy. The Quaz has become my absolute pride and joy.
Yeah.
I get no money off of it. I don't even know how many reads it always gets. But I was watching The Wonder Years with my kids. We were really into The Wonder Years for a while, which used to be my favorite show as a kid.
It's a great show.
And I was sitting there, and I was like, I wonder what happened to Kevin Arnold's girlfriend on The Wonder Years. Not Winnie Cooper, but one of his other girlfriends. And so I Googled her, and she was like, she's like a motivational Christian speaker in Northern California, Wendy Hagen, who's become a friend, I got to say. And I emailed her, and I was like, I have this website. Would you be up for a Q&A? And she said sure. So I sent her the questions, and she was great. And I was trying to think of a name for it, and I thought, I'm going to do people who are quasi-famous. It's going to be like quasi-famous. So I call it the Quaz. The funny thing is, like, I can't tell people what it means because I've actually had some famous people on. And also, you don't want, like, people who are, like, kind of fading celebrities to think I think of them as quasi-famous. So I just call it the Quaz and don't tell anyone why it's a Quaz.
Except me.
No, yeah. Except you, but I'm okay with that. And it's kind of funny.
So
I have,
funny.
Like, number... And I actually thought it was going to be like one of these things that, well, maybe I'll do 20 or 30. And next week is number 200.
Wow.
So, and every week, 200 weeks. So.
Yeah, that's excellent. That's really fun.
Yeah, I really love it. I like addicted to it. Totally.
So now I have to tell you my favorite Wonder Years scene. Okay.
Oh,
so.
Please.
the opening is the opening of the show, and you're just seeing like darkness and you don't know what it is, and then all of a sudden things start moving away from the camera and you realize that people are removing objects, and it's the parents, and they are cleaning out a closet, and then all of a sudden, and you're in the closet basically as the viewer, and then all of a sudden they find a toilet and they realize that this closet in their house that they always thought was a closet is a bathroom.
Wow.
And it's so messy that no one ever knew it was a bathroom. And so she's
wow,
like,
that's awesome.
Put everything back. Don't tell the kids. We have a third bathroom. It was very funny. Sorry.
Okay. I'm still haunted by the final episode of The Wonder Years is, you know, you don't know if Kevin and Winnie are going to end up together. And you have Daniel Stern, who is a narrator for the show, talking about what happened to everyone. And the dad died. And he was like, and 20 years later, Winnie and I got together. We're, you know, and Winnie and I were still together. And there was like, last week for dinner, she with her husband and me with my wife and two kids. And it was like, ah, heartbreaking.
Heartbreaking. And you know what? I've just now realized that I totally screwed up. That wasn't The Wonder Years. That was Malcolm in the Middle. I'm sorry.
Oh, come on. That's great CTV compared to The Wonder Years.
I liked them both, but okay. Never mind. Sorry. I liked both, actually. I just forgot about The Wonder Years.
No,
it's a little
you're
farther
right.
back.
Wait, who's the star? Who's the star of Malcolm in the Middle?
Well, the father went on to do Breaking Bad, but I forget anybody's name because I'm bad at that.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. All right,
yeah.
There you go. I didn't watch Malcolm in the Middle. I don't even know if it was great.
Oh, my God. It's very funny. Okay. We're almost done here. I want to circle back to the beginning, to your work on the University of Delaware paper, the review. We've talked a little bit about this, but you write of your former self, I was a punk-ass loser with no self-control and the inability to understand that my story was meaningless and disposable. So, and then you told a couple stories about how, you know, you think that you learned from this mistake and started to mature. But I wondered what it was like when you got into sort of more mainstream media. You know, like, you've written for Sports Illustrated, and, like, was that still a component of your personality, or had you really kind of beaten it by then?
I think, that's a good question. I mean, you know, like this is, I don't really express this very often. I can't even think of the last time I ever did, if I ever did. Like, you know you're good at what you do. Like, you know, like,
right.
It's not like I think I'm bad at being a journalist. You know, like, I know I've had, like, a really, like, charmed career. You know, like, you've written a bunch of bestsellers, and you wrote for Sports Illustrated. So it's not, you know, it's like, so I know, like, I'm good at this. Like,
right.
I think I'm good at this. You know, I've had a pretty good career. You know, the books sell. People seem to like it. So, but I think what has changed for me is I realize that it's all pretty meaningless at the end of the day. Like, I'm not even just saying that as a cliche. Like, one day I'm going to die, and nobody's going to read books anyway, and they're all just going to vanish. Nobody's going to give a crap, you know. And I'm totally fine with that. I actually think that's a good awareness to have, because what I used to think is everything matters, and every story you write, how can you change that comma? How can you change that period? What are you doing? How can you change that? That's the perfect wording. How can you do that? And that was me for years and years and years.
Right.
Furious over anybody who had the audacity to edit anything I wrote or change anything I wrote. And I still take pride in my work, and I still want it to be really good, but I'm also aware that at the end of the day, there are 8 million things more important than my next book, you know. And, like, you do your best, you hope it's good, but there's a firefighter out there, there's a soldier out there, there's a doctor out there, there's a teacher out there who has a much, 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 much more important job than I do.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm lucky beyond belief that I've been able to do this for a living. I mean, I never wear shoes. I never have to go into a meeting. I've never had to talk about sales reports or my, you know, what our hedge fund is doing. Like, it's not, those are not things I concern myself with very often. And I'm really lucky. I'm standing on a patio in California overlooking mountains. I mean, this is, I've had as good a life as anyone could have. But I think what was really important for me as a person is to realize that, you know, what today's writing is tomorrow's fish wrap, and it doesn't really matter that much.
Okay. I wanted to kind of change the direction of the subject of ego and ask you about your opinion of today's journalism. It seems like a lot of mainstream newscasters, mainly, you know, television newscasters, make their opinion a part of the news. And it seems like that's the norm now. And like Walter Cronkite and the Huntley-Brinkley Report, you know, would have no place in today's journalism. For me personally, it's a little discouraging, but I just wondered what your take is on that.
I hate it. I really hate it. John Stewart said not that long ago, he said, the problem, what we have today, is we have 24-hour news networks, and you have to fill 24 hours of when there's not news. You know,
right.
Like, we don't live in a world where there's usually, you know, 9/11 doesn't happen every day, or, you know, an assassination attempt or a coup or whatever. Like, those things don't happen every day. So you're trying to fill all that space. And how do we fill that space? And how do we draw viewers? Well, we get these blowhards with really strong, divisive opinions, and we let them say whatever they want. And the problem is, like you said, like, people tuned into Walter Cronkite to hear the news, to hear what was going on that day. Same with Peter Dennings and Tom Brokaw and Dan Rather. Nowadays, people tune to the news station of their choice to hear the information that they will agree with. So if you're a liberal, you're turning to MSNBC because they're going to reinforce your beliefs. And if you're conservative, you'll go to Fox News and they'll reinforce your beliefs. And nobody's learning anything. And there's no dialogue and there's no exchanging of ideas. And, I mean, I mentioned Ted Cruz before. My problem with Ted Cruz are not his beliefs per se, which I don't share, but I'm okay with that. Like, my problem is the unwillingness to even talk to the other side and to converse,
right,
and to have exchanges. And, you know, Ronald Reagan, Tip O'Neill. I mean, you know, those were relationships that happened back then. And nowadays, if you have the audacity to strike a deal with someone from an opposition party, you're treasonous.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's really dripped into news and to talk radio. And it's just so venomous and so poisonous. And it's made me a non-news watcher. I generally find everything I need online and different newspapers.
Right. That's sort of what happens, isn't it? We just kind of leave the medium. And so the medium fights harder for our attention by being even more sensational.
I don't need Bill O'Reilly or Al Sharpton. I don't need to hear your opinion. I am a smart enough human being that I can form my own opinion without you yelling it at me. I just don't need it.
Yeah, and you did mention both sides of the aisle, which is important to do because I do think it exists on both sides. So
when people kill Fox News and praise MSNBC, or praise praise Fox News and kill MSNBC, come on, it's basically the same animal. They're you know, trying to reinforce positions that their viewers will agree with instead of trying to just inform in an unbiased way.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh well.
on that set.
Now I'm gonna go stab my wrist. It's the worst. I hate this stuff. It really is a bummer. It's such a bummer, but it is what it is.
Well, actually, I'm going to end on an up note, which is, you know, you can inject your opinion into your blog, but you tell good stories and good history in your books, and I really enjoyed Showtime. I just want to thank you for sending me a sports history to read, because I never probably would have otherwise.
I was under the impression that I was going to do this show because you were a sports expert.
Yes.
So I feel very misled.
I'm sorry. All right, so I just want to
sports talk. I thought this was your hourly sports talk show.
Only today. This is my debut sports episode. Anyway, okay, so I want to say one more time: Showtime, Magic, Kareem, Riley, and the Los Angeles Lakers: Dynasty of the 1980s by Jeff Perlman, and published by Gotham Books. Jeff, this was really fun. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Jeff Perlman. You can learn more about his work at his website, jeffperlman.com. From there, you can find information about his books, articles, blog, and the Quaz, which several thousand people now know the meaning of, because, of course, when he told me, he told you. Oh, well, we can keep a secret. From Jeff's website, you can also read a blog post that I wrote back in November about being what I call sports blind. The post is called Wait, So Who's Playing Again? And I will put a link to that on my podcast site. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by Main Street Landing, creating places for people to work, play, entertain, meet, eat, and greet on Burlington's beautiful waterfront. Main Street Landing rents office and retail space as well as daily rentals for meetings, events, and performances in their Performing Arts Center. Contact Melinda at 802-864-7999 or mainstreetlanding.com. And by Calamity and Crow's trading post, Twisting Fresh Tie-Dyes, for individuals, businesses, and organizations with standards like eyeballs, jerry bears, peace signs, and their signature tie-dyed mule. Custom artisan tie-dyes that rock. Contact Calamity and Crow's trading post on Facebook. This week's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my guest, Jeff Perlman. He actually offered two. First, look around your room, whatever room you're sitting in, and choose something. For example, Jeff mentioned seeing a pineapple in his office when he was explaining this to me. I don't know why he has pineapple in his office, but he does. So he said, you know, choose something that you see, and then you have to use the word for that thing in your next sentence. So he had to use pineapple in his next sentence, and he says it has to be a viable sentence. It can't just be nonsensical. And in this case, he might then try to compare basketball to the look and feel of a pineapple, maybe the stickiness or the texture. He says it might not last. It might not make the final cut when it comes to finalizing his draft, but it often helps him to keep going when the work is slowed down. And it presents a kind of fun challenge to try to work a word in that you otherwise might not have used. And then a second recommendation that Jeff makes is to listen to old school hip hop while you write. He suggests choosing a jazz infused hip hop like A Tribe Called Quest or Black Sheep. Jeff feels that the flow of really good hip hop is similar to the flow of writing. He says that some of his best work was written while he was listening to old school hip hop. So there you go, two writing ideas from Jeff Perlman. Good luck with them, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. And you can also access the podcast and my blog, The Silent G, by going to my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. The Radiator exists solely thanks to volunteers and community support and involvement. More information about getting involved at The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. Thank you.